Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Negligence, the Dylan Redwine story. I'm Eric Carter Londeen, and this is True Consequences. When we last left off, I was speaking with Bob Mata, who is a former defense attorney turned podcaster on the show Defense Diaries. Again, if you haven't checked that show out, please go check it out. We're going to pick up where Bob and I left off last week, talking about the trial. So we left off, we were talking about the trial. We were starting to get into that. And I think that not being a defense attorney, not knowing anything about that world, other than being a family member of a victim, it was very clear. And I almost had a thought early on in the trial. It almost felt like the defense team was being purposely out of it, I guess. I
don't know, man. I just don't think the guy was prepared. You know, it's like, I've seen lawyers that kind of wing it in a closing, and I got that distinct feeling because, like, when a guy just kind of repeats the same shit about 50 times during the closing, yeah, you know that, number one, that they don't have a strong case because they're trying to, you know, kind of just beat a dead horse with respect to kind of the same point over and over and over. And I really got that feeling, like, the first hour of that, like, before he kind of, like, started delving into the evidence, you know, I really just kind of got the feeling like, wow, this guy's really pushing the reasonable doubt angle, like, hard, you know, which, you know, I always consider that to be, like, kind of the catch-all, you know, like, if you don't have the evidence on your side, you're basically arguing reasonable doubt that they weren't able to prove their case. So as opposed to the evidence not really reflecting that the guy did it, you know what I mean? So that was definitely the feeling I got from them. It was certainly not a sterling performance by the defense. No. And I didn't particularly think that the prosecution was great either. I was relieved that, you know, it went the way that it did, because I think at the end of the day, I think there's no other rational explanation of what happened to this kid. No part of me thinks that he was hiking, you know.
He didn't go fishing.
Didn't go fishing. He wasn't walking 21 fucking miles to his buddy's house, you know, at the crack of dawn. That wasn't happening, you know. And that
highway, by the way, that they, you know, were trying to say that Mark was trying to say, oh, maybe he went to walk to Ryan's house. That highway is scary as shit to drive on, let alone to walk on.
No way. No 13-year-old kids walking 21 miles. My daughter, my 16-year-old, won't walk like 3 blocks. I'm like, oh, you know, it's like I've turned into my father. You know, I used to have to, like, walk 4 miles to school every day. You know, she's like, oh, my God. And, you know, with no shoes and the stuff. So it's like, but that's just, you know, that's how kids are. And it's like 13-year-old. It's not happening, dude. And it's like his entire family is like, this kid is not the kid who's going to go fishing. You know, no. I'm going to wake up real early and go fish. It's like he had plans. He had plans to see his homie. You know, he had plans to go hang out with his homie. And, like, I didn't think that was unusual. Like you said, Mark's romanticizing what he wants his relationship with his son to be. Mm-hmm. From Dylan's perspective, he's like, I'm 13. I want to go hang out with my friends. I don't want to hang out with my creepy dad. That's what he's thinking, you know? Like, so I didn't think that was, you know, like, because the state made a big deal out about that. And I'm like, nah, you know, if I'm a juror and I'm back and trying to, like, figure out if this guy's guilty or not, and we're back there hashing it out, like, those would be things where I'm saying, look, like, those aren't compelling to me. That's just a 13-year-old being a 13-year-old. I don't think that it was a situation that you know, the kid was necessarily trying to distance himself from his father. You know, I don't think that it was strange that he didn't want to go. Like, that was for many reasons. I think probably the primary reason, you know, I mean, I know that grandmother was ill, and I, you know, and that was kind of the narrative that Elaine was pushing, you know, that was one of the main reasons he wanted to stay back, because he wanted to spend the holiday, you know, with his grandmother, who might not make it to the next holiday. Right. And that certainly was a major factor for him. But just he's on Thanksgiving break. He's 13. He's got friends. He doesn't fucking want to go into the mountains with his dad.
He has a girlfriend. He has a girlfriend that he's spending time with every day.
Exactly, dude. Like, that's just not what 13-year-olds want to do. So it's like, well, they try, you know, like, because those were kind of red herrings for me a little bit.
I do think, though, that he did have that. Elaine said this, and it made sense to me based on Mark and his behavior, was that Dylan wanted to be out. He wanted to go do things. Mark did not. Mark wanted to be home watching TV.
And like I said, I mean, the state had a tough case. I mean, circumstantial cases are tough. You know, when the state's trying to build their case and they have evidence trickling in, and, you know, they don't discover, you know, the first set of, you know, remains until like almost a year after Dylan's gone missing. And then another couple of years go by before they discover the skull, you know, and at that point, they're trying to build a case, you know, and it's like everybody in law enforcement liked Mark from the get, you know, and it's one of those situations where they just don't have the evidence, you know,
which is why you hear them kind of pleading with him to confess over and over and over again. Yeah,
totally. You know,
and they try to play on every possible angle. They're like, oh, you're a dad, you love your kid. If you love your kid, you're gonna tell us what really happened, even if it was an accident. Like,
totally. Yeah, they took every angle, man. They took every shot they could at him, like, you know, from every emotional angle that they could come at him with. And, you know,
it didn't work.
It didn't, because his time was his friend in his mind, Mark. You know, the longer that it went, the more distant he became to the actual event. You know what I'm saying? So it was like any kind of emotional leverage that they may have had on him early in terms of getting him to kind of fess it up, you know, it's always going to happen closer in time to the event, you know, because it's like, if you've got any kind of soul as a human being, and you're kind of a tortured soul at that point, if you've done something horrific like that, you know, so that's something that you're dealing with on a daily basis, like all day, every day. Like, you know, I just, me personally, I'm a terrible liar, you know, like I'm just not good at lying. So that wouldn't have been an option for me. Apparently Mark, you know, he's a fucking sociopath, man. I mean, that there's no bones about it. You know, fetishes and his weirdness aside, the guy just acted. I mean, he reminded me of Gacy, to be honest with you, the way that he was so remorseless, you know. And it's like, I get from his perspective why he's not trying to end up, you know, in prison for the rest of his life. But man, it's your kid, you know, it's just like, it's your kid. I just don't know. You've got to be, he's built differently than the rest of us. You know,
he,
it's like,
he has to be. I mean, there's just, I can't fathom listening to him in those interview tapes. It's just like, how can you sit there?
Right.
And just,
it's crazy,
you know, and he would go in and out between like the cool, fun, jovial guy to just bold-faced lying and just making shit up.
Totally.
And he knows that they know that he's making shit up, and he doesn't care.
The bleeding cold sore. Yeah,
it was a Nerf football.
Come on. Yeah. I mean, dude, it's like the whole way. You know, and he didn't have much time to kind of like play it out, you know, because you figure, let's assume that what went down is exactly what went down, that, you know, and I'm assuming that he didn't really kill his child purposefully. I think it was a heated, you know, it would have been like a second degree or a manslaughter charge. Like, I think the state probably, if they wanted to take the safe route, could have downgraded the charge and probably had an easier time like mentally going in, because, you know, it's like, we know this guy did it, and, you know, we don't have the greatest evidence in the world, but we know he did it, and, you know, we just have to hope that the jury can see through this guy's bullshit. And, you know, so it's like, you have that situation where, you know, if they would have like kind of switched up the narrative and not gone with like the violent murdering like hatchet man type narrative, and gone with, you know, they got into it, it got physical. You know, the guy, like you said, was already on tilt because mm-hmm. of everything that had been going on with the, you know, just recently decided case. So, you know, he was not in a good space. Plus, he's a raging alcoholic, you know,
right.
And I don't know when, like, I didn't hear much evidence about like what he had consumed that day, you know, which to me is always a factor with respect to how people respond to certain things that are happening to them when they're intoxicated. And, you know, I mean, I'm assuming this guy was drinking because that's what he did. You know, he was a beer drinking guy, man.
Oh yeah. And you hear him in the interviews. He is slurring all over the place. And you're like, whoa, this guy is hammered.
It's really a fascinating case, man. And it's like one of those cases where, you know, you kind of sit back and you watch it develop and, you know, everyone has their own feelings on it. And I can't imagine, just because of the way that he responded over the years with respect to his son being missing and, you know, that everyone felt like he was the guy, you know, and I think that everyone feels like it was the right result and that there was some justice done for Dylan. And, you know, it's one of those things that we just never really know, though. You know, it's like I'm always like, man, I wish that every fucking guy that went in prison that always maintained their innocence on their deathbed, like that there was some kind of way that we could just force them to tell the truth so we could always know. Like, I would like to think that if I was like some kind of horrific person like that, you know, that on my deathbed, I'd be like, you know what? I'm going to tell you. But like, people just don't do that. It's
so frustrating. The trial itself, I think you said it went 5 weeks.
Yeah.
It's kind of a blur for me because I was rushing every morning to wake up in time to go stream it on my YouTube channel. Right. And then of course everything would go wrong and technology would fail me. And then I'd be mad. But yeah, it was hard to keep track of how long it went, but I remember it feeling like forever. It really did.
Dude, like, and imagine sitting on a jury. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
And that's one of the things when you're like trying a case like that, it's like you have to, because you're going to have witnesses that are explosive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you're going to have the Elaines and the Brandons and the Coreys that get up there that are giving just heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching testimony mm-hmm. that will have the jury, you know, all in. And then you'll have like the, you know, I call it like the parade of experts where, you know, the juries just fucking fade out, man, because it's boring, you know, and it's all esoteric, you know, medical shit or mm-hmm. scientific shit that, you know, unless you've got a scientist who's on the jury, who's like, oh, this is fascinating. You know, I mean, most of the people are going to be like, oof, you know, how long is this going to go on? Those are the witnesses that make these types of things drag on, you know, and it's like, when you're looking at it from the jury's perspective, and that's what I try to explain to my listeners, I'm like, look, you know, theoretically, depending on the, you know, kind of how high profile the case was, mm-hmm. you know, they might not have heard any of the facts, you know, so it's all new to them, you know, and then you're trying to craft the narrative and both sides have their stories and both sides are trying to, you know, basically prove them. And you know, the concept of that you're innocent until proven guilty. And that's one of the things from like a defense attorney's perspective. It's not really like that. You know, like when I go in, I feel like I have to prove my guy's innocent, you know, because, and that's one of the things like during voir dire, when I'm picking a jury, I'd be like, you know, I need to know, like, if you've walked in here with a preconceived notion just by way of him being arrested and the fact mm-hmm. that he's in front of you, have you formed an opinion as to his innocence or guilt just based on that alone? And you know, when people are being truthful, because we're human beings, they're like, well, yeah, you know, I mean, he's here, they definitely have some shit on him. So it's like I'm already behind the eight ball like before the trial's even begun, just by way of the guy sitting next to me.
Yeah, even if, you know, the burden of proof is on the prosecution,
right,
it doesn't matter. You still have to find a way to poke holes in what they're saying.
Totally.
It sounds cute and nice, but it doesn't really work that way.
Yeah, right. In reality, that's not how it fleshes out, man. And it's like, from a defense attorney's perspective, you know, the state has all the resources. I've been handling cases for people for 20 years, and I handle cases for way less than, you know, I should be making in terms of the amount of work that goes into preparing properly for a trial, because I want people to have the opportunity to have good representation where they haven't been able to get it, you know, because like there's some great public defenders out there, but the bottom line is the public defenders have a massive caseload and they just
They're overworked and underpaid.
And they can't dedicate the time that they need to, that like a private attorney would be able to, because they don't have that caseload. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, and the state's got all the resources. They basically have everything that they need. There's like an endless supply of money in terms of getting experts in there. Mm-hmm. There's an endless, you know, outreach to law enforcement, anything that they need done, you know? So it's like, as defense attorneys, if you've got a client that's basically indigent, I don't have any access to any of that. And then I'm going into court filing motion saying, look, I need the county to pay so I can get an expert to get this guy evaluated. And they're like, okay, well, I'm going to give you $2,500. So good luck. Find some hack to basically, you know what I mean? So, and it's been like that, and soon find out that it's almost impossible because the red tape and just the power of the state is so overwhelming, you know? And it's like, so it becomes very disheartening from our perspective, like right away, you know.
You're making me feel bad for Morin and Bogan. And I wasn't, but yeah, you're right. They did have the odds against them in that situation, and the sheer amount of motions that were filed and the sheer amount of exhibits that were brought forward. I mean, I would have a hard time knowing what exhibits were coming up and where they are in the binder and, you know, where they are on the computer. Like, it would be impossible. I had a hard time just producing this season.
Yeah, man. I mean, and it's like, it's overwhelming. Like if I was handling Mark's thing, I would just be focusing on the motion work, and I would have been focusing a lot more on everything that happened during the investigation. Like that's what I do. I focus on the constitutionality. That's what I defend the Constitution as opposed to my guy, because I know I've done my job if I'm doing that, because that's really what the concern is. A lot of times, like I said in the beginning, you're defending the principles of the Constitution. Did the cops in investigating it do everything properly, you know? And that's the way, when people ask, well, how do you defend a monster like that? Well, that's how, you know, I take whatever they may have done or what they did do out of the equation in terms of me being able to kind of plunge forward and handle what I need to handle in order for
me
to be
procedure.
You have to, you know, I mean, because I'm a human, you know, and I'm like an extremely, like I said, I'm an emotional guy, you know, it's like, I have kids and, you know, people matter to me, you know? So it's like, those are things that, you know, when I go into it, but there's so much shit with it, like in the criminal justice system, that like, you need people that give a shit, you know, you really do. It's like the worst guys are the bottom feeder scumbags that just go in and are trying to make a buck. Those guys are just like, and it doesn't matter what side they're on, you know, whether they're prosecutor or defense, they're just a blight. And, you know, and there's just so many lawyers, you know, and you're bound to have a bunch of really shitty lawyers, you know, that give like everyone a bad name, you know, and it's like, that's all it takes. And, you know, you always hope, as flawed as our system is, that at the end of the day, that, you know, you're going to get some justice, you know, and I know that your struggle, you know, that you've been going through with what's going on with your brother is just like fucking never ending and heartbreaking, man. You know, it's like, you know, coming from that side of it, like where it's just hit you like so hard personally, and having to try to like fucking, you know, change your focus into finding a way to get justice, you know, to use that energy and that anger that's built up over, you know, your life, you know, to try to like channel it into a way to try to make a difference. You know, it's like, I love you, man. I just think you're a fucking awesome guy, man. I really do.
Thank you. I love you too. I respect you. And that means a lot. I kind of want to go down a little rabbit hole that could be risky.
I love rabbit holes. So I love it.
If you were going to represent Mark, what would you have done differently than what his team did?
And that's a tough one. You know, I know. Because it is, you know, because when I look at a case like that, and I've got a case where I've got a guy who's basically just coming into my office and just denying, okay, he's denying involvement from the get. Mm-hmm. And I start looking at the evidence, and I start looking at his demeanor, and I start looking at how he's been acting. And, you know, I'm not a fucking robot. I'm a human. I have my own personal feelings. So in that type of situation, I probably would have tried to push Mark towards And this, of course, would have been, you know, attorney-client privilege. And I would have, like, knowing that he's not going to testify, because it, like, that's kind of the I should have prefaced, like, I don't ask my client if they did it if I think that they might have to testify, because I can't put them on to suborn perjury if I come up with an alternative defense. If they admit it to me, they're done. There's no way they go on the stand, because I would never put a client on to suborn perjury. So in that situation where I know that Mark is never going to testify because he could never help himself, I probably would have tried to go with a mental illness defense of some type, man, to be honest with you. I would have said, look, man, like, we can go with this thing, and I'm going to tell you how this is going to play out if we do it your way, where you're just going to say it wasn't me, it's going to animal ate my kid. You know, we're never going to be able to explain away how you acted after the fact. That's just not going away. And there's no rational explanation for it. No 12 people on the planet are going to buy this shit. You acted like a fucking person who killed his kid. That's how you did it. So why don't we contemplate getting an expert in here and have them maybe do a brain scan, maybe see what's going on with you. Maybe you've got some issues mentally. You've definitely got some mental illness going on, mm-hmm. on top of it being exacerbated by your alcoholism and, you know, whatever else you're doing. And I think, he was a guy that I probably would have taken an entirely different approach, you know, and which ultimately might have been far more satisfying for a jury. You know, I mean, there's never going to be an excuse for it, but, you know, at least there is some acknowledgement of what happened, and then, you know, trying to explain in that moment of absolute horror for both Mark, and then just change the narrative, change it from like, I didn't fucking do it, and I acted like a total dick afterward, to, oh my God, you know, it was like, I just went through like the worst moment of my life.
Yeah. That creates an argument for lowering charges, right? That creates an argument for
totally. Like that would have been my play, but like all the whole way. I would have said, look, man, you know, like I said, I would have gone, let's say theoretically, okay, I'm going to give you a hypothetical, Mark. Mm-hmm. Let's say that, you know, Dylan got in, you guys were kind of on shaky footing, you know, you knew that he'd found this shit on you, and you know, that he was, you know, he probably had some issues with you that were pretty deep seated at this point. You know, he gets out there, you know, and it's awkward. You know, you guys are, you're not feeling the love, and, you know, you guys get back to the house, and, you know, he had wanted to go over to his buddy's house. You quash that. You're like, nah, it's not happening. You just got here. You're staying with me tonight. You know what I mean? It's like, which is, I'm sure, exactly what went down. You know, yeah. The kid probably was like, I want to hang out with my friends, man. You know? So, and then it just turned physical. Like, and it was done unintentionally. It was, you know, it got physical. You shouldn't have put hands on Dylan, but you did. And there was a physical altercation, and it got out of hand. And like, I threw him, you know, I just tossed him to kind of get him off me because he was attacked, whatever, however it would have played out in terms of what the story was. But then you don't have a jury looking at this guy like he's a thing, like a, just like the piece of shit that he is. Mm-hmm. You have a father who mishandled massively a situation that had boiled over, and it got physical, and a mm-hmm. terrible accident happened. You know, I mean, that, to me, that would have been the better approach if I was like, because I would have sold them on that by saying, look, you know, if I can get them to drop that to a manslaughter or, you know, a second degree, you're not looking at spending the rest of your life in prison, you know, right. And you're going to do, because in you're not going to win this case the way right. that you want to handle it, dude. You know, that's what I would have gone with, that approach with him. And I would have hoped to have convinced him of it, you know, but, you know, at the end of the day, he would have been found guilty just as well. But
yeah,
I think people would have been satisfied. There would have been much more palatable, you know, for like for Elaine, for his brothers, to just have this guy admit it, you know, and just there were extenuating circumstances and it got out of control. And I obviously didn't mean to kill him, you know, it just,
right.
It, you know, so like that. That's probably how I would have gone about it, man. You know, it seems like the right approach in that particular case, because as much as it was entirely circumstantial, there's no other explanation. You know, I mean, that's the key. I don't give a shit what the evidence is. I don't give a shit how crappy the DNA or the dog sniff and all that shit is. There's no other explanation. There's no, like, you're the last guy to see him, and the kid vanished off the face of the earth. There's no, like, and there's no viable explanation.
And I think that the prosecution did a really good job of pointing that out and saying, like, this kid replied within minutes to instantly everybody that he wanted
all the time.
And so he never responded to you for 2.5 months, but he was constantly in contact with people that he cared about.
Right.
And
his friends, his family, yeah, immediately. It's
and
like,
for him,
you know,
to
like
drop off like that, it was unheard of.
9:37. You know, that's when it happened. Like, that's like, that number is like burned in my brain. You know, that's the last time the kid ever made any contact with anybody. And we're talking about a 13-year-old at 9:30 at night. Nope.
No way.
It's not how it happens, man. That's not how it works. My 16-year-old's up till 3 a.m. That's the reality of that situation. That's like, none of it added up, man. You know, and there's just no other reasonable explanation. So it's like, I don't know. When I get a case in like that, you know, I try to look at it from every angle. I look at the strength of the state's case, and I'm, you know, I said, look, I know you're sitting here telling me you didn't do it, but I need you to seriously think about what I'm going to discuss with you right now. And, you know, I want you to sleep on it for a few nights and think about this approach. And, you know, I think this might be the way to go. And, you know, that's certainly what I would have done in that case. I would have put on a completely different case. If Mark would have persisted that he didn't do it, I would have had to put on the same bullshit case. You know what I mean? I would have had to have done that. And basically the only move that they had was try to attack the science,
right?
You know, cause there's no way they did, you know, I mean, that was really their only move, because, mm-hmm, you know, him trying to like come off, like he came off disingenuous, the defense attorney did in the closing,
sure,
like you know, oh, no big deal. Oh, it's a big deal that he's walking 2 feet behind his dad. And like, what, 13? Yeah. I'm like, dude, that's not the approach. That's not how you're getting the jury to think that this guy didn't do it, man. Like my approach would have been vastly different than his, but it would essentially have been the same defense, you know? I mean, because it's all I would have had if I couldn't talk Mark into doing what I would have thought would have been the better approach, you know?
Yeah.
I would have certainly tried. And I don't know that these guys didn't, but I have a feeling that they did not.
It's hard to say, you know, it's possible that they did try and he turned them down knowing how he is. Right. One of the things that really bothered me about Bogan is he had this tendency to snicker at people.
Oh, my God. Right.
He's cross-examining them
and during the closing, in this whole thing where he puts his hands over his face and he's like, dude, this is not the time to laugh.
No,
you know, in some cases, I'll try to inject a little humor if it's a long case, but I'm certainly not laughing inappropriately, I felt the exact same way, like, especially during the closing.
Yeah.
Like, where he's just like laughing at like how, like, oh, how ridiculous this is, you know? It's just like, it's not like, you're not going to ingratiate yourself with the jury when you're doing that shit, man. It's not.
Yeah. I think I don't think that helped at all.
There's no way.
Yeah, it came off really bad.
It did. It's like, because you know what they always say in the law game is like, you know, if the law is against you and the facts are against you, you got to basically, it boils down to, you got to make the jury like you more than they like the prosecutor. Mm-hmm. And like, he did not do that. You don't need to do it that way. You can kind of pick their case apart without demeaning them, which, you know, like him kind of like inappropriately laughing throughout the entire trial, mm-hmm, with that weird snicker thing that he did was just horribly misplayed. But that might just be his personality, and the guy's not like a great trial lawyer, you know. I mean, it's hard trying cases, you know, you're acting, I think I remember telling you about this, and I was like, that was one of the things that I felt like prepared me to be a podcaster, to tell stories, because it's what I do. You know, mm-hmm, I tell a story. I'm telling a story, and I try to do it in a way that's compelling. And, you know, so like, that kind of like trained me to do what we do. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And it was like, he's just not a very good storyteller. You know what I mean? At the end of the day. But yeah, man, dude, yeah, his demeanor was off for sure. You know, and sometimes it's hard, like, strategically how you handle a witness. It makes such a big difference, man. It's tough, man. I mean, it's a tough gig.
I think that people forget a number of things, right? I think that people forget, first of all, that this is real life. When they're into true crime, they forget that this is the worst day of somebody's life,
yep,
or the worst day of multiple people's lives that, yep, we're talking about. They also forget that the people in the justice system are human.
Yep.
Right. And, yep. and that they're going with the best intentions sometimes and doing the best that they can for the most part. There are probably right. exceptions to that, but at the same time, like the system itself is flawed because people are flawed, right?
Of course.
Not because the Constitution's flawed or any of those other things are flawed. It's just that people are flawed. And so
fundamentally flawed.
And I think we want everything to be tied up in a nice, neat box, you know, and then put away so we don't have to think about it. But that's not how it works in real life.
It's not how it works at all, man. It's that's so poignant that you said that. And that's so true, you know, and I'm always trying to make that point to people. And it's not just the lawyers, it's the judge. Like everybody involved in that process is a human being. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have any idea what's going on in their life and their, you know, and their private life. And, you know, those things affect all of us as we, you know, work from day to day. You know, it's like we drag our personal shit into mm-hmm. work, you know. So certainly the system's flawed, you know, like in terms of, because like follow the fucking money is just unfortunately how the world runs, man. Like for everything, you follow the money and it's no different in the criminal justice system. But like when you're getting down into the minutiae of it, like in any kind of individual case, you're dealing with people. You know, everybody's a person. Everybody is like, we're not robots. And no one is, you know, like the jury, they're not robots. The judge, everyone's got emotions. Everyone's got feelings. Everyone's got thoughts. Everyone's got biases. Everyone, you know, so those are all, you know, things that you try to factor in and, you know, you just try to do the best job that you can typically from both sides of it, you know.
And listeners and viewers of true crime, I think it's really easy to see things from the 1,000-foot view, the 10,000-foot view that the people involved in those situations didn't have the luxury of having, right?
Yeah, hindsight's 20/20, dude.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like when you're in the shit in the moment, it's completely different, you know? It's like, and it's like you said, man, it's like you're looking at a situation when you're watching Discovery ID. It's all after the fact and it doesn't seem real because it seems like you're watching a movie, but in reality, these were all just like you, exactly like you said, this is somebody's absolute worst day of their life, probably multiple people's worst day of their life that they're talking about. And, you know, that has to be taken into consideration all the time. And it's like, it's hard, you know, and
it is.
Like for what we do professionally, you know, it's different, you know, because we take these deep dives into these cases and, you know, we're able to kind of inject ourselves into the situation and look at it in a different way, which I think is the beauty of podcasting. Like there's just no other medium that can do what we can do. You know, that's why people love it, you know, especially the true crime game, man. It's like, like they can't do that in documentaries. They just can't. They don't have the time. They don't have the ability to be able to dive in like we can. And we get to inject our own kind of our own mores and you know, those types of things into what we're saying in order to try to give context. And people may agree or disagree with what we're saying or how we feel about it. But nonetheless, it creates a dialogue and it creates, you know, thought, you know, which is like, to me, dialogue is always the way to go about anything. And like people can disagree on shit. That's like, so it makes it amazing to be a human being. I mean, it would suck if we all thought the exact same way about everything, you know? I mean,
yeah, I can barely tolerate myself. I don't need more of me. So I want to circle back to the trial and then, and then get your closing thoughts and then we'll wrap this up. So, okay. So the trial wrapped up in 5 weeks.
Yep.
Mark Redwine was found guilty of both charges that he was brought to trial for. And he was sentenced to the maximum 48 years, which is the most that he could have received for those charges. So I'm so grateful that the outcome was what it was and that it worked out that way, because I was getting nervous that there was some reasonable doubt being sewed into there. But it seems like the jury, again, you know, saw through a lot of it and saw Mark for who he was. And so I'm very grateful for that. I want to get your final thoughts. And then I want you to wrap it up with telling my listeners how to find you.
Okay. So, you know, essentially kind of what I'd like to, so Mark, I'm sure has filed his notice of appeal and, you know, there's the whole appellate process, but And you and I had talked about, like, kind of going into this, that we would have loved to have been able to get the transcripts. Like, when I can pour through the transcripts to try to determine if there's any kind of real issue, like an appellate issue. Mm-hmm. And, like, I don't know if your listeners know, but, like, when you hear lawyers objecting at trial, okay, like, the purpose of that is that they are basically creating an appellate issue. So when you hear an objection, it's not just like they're trying to break the flow. I mean, it has that added benefit sometimes, mm-hmm. but typically, like, anytime you hear an objection at trial, that's because they're saying, look, a rule of evidence has been broken. Okay. And that rule of evidence was crucial to the case. And now my client's not getting a fair trial or what have you. So anytime you hear those objections, they're critical. Like, it's so, like, say for instance, if his attorneys hadn't objected to anything, he would literally not have any appellate issues because it's considered waived. So if you don't object at trial, it's done. There is no, wow. There's no going. Yeah. So that's like the, like, in like, that's the kind of shit that I try to explain in my show. It's like, cause when people are watching trials, they're like, oh my God, why do they keep having these fucking sidebars? And why does the guy keep fucking objecting all the time? And, you know, and sometimes it is done to stop a flow. Like if you've got mm-hmm. a devastating, you know, cross-examination or direct examination with a witness who's just destroying your client, you know, and you're like, oh my God, I've got to try to do something to slow their roll. You know, in that case, it might be that. But so, you know, when you and I talked about getting the transcripts, like that would have allowed me to kind of go in and be like, all right, like, Eric, you don't have to worry. This guy's got no real appellate issues, you know, so not knowing, you know, but we watched like a lot of the trial, you know, mm-hmm. and anything that I didn't see anything in terms of us having to be worried about this thing being reversed on appeal and, you know, getting kicked back to the trial court to retry it. And that, you know, cause that's typically what happens. Like if it gets reversed on appeal, it gets kicked back to the trial court and they typically retry the case, you know? So it's not like if they went on appeal, they're free, you know, they right. basically just say, well, all right, we're tossing that trial. So,
well, that's taking years and years too, right?
Yeah. Years. It does take years. It takes years. And they're really hard to win. Like it's gotta be pretty egregious. It's typically gotta be something that, you know, is so egregious that the defendant just truly didn't get a fair trial. Cause like the appellate court is abhors sending shit back to retry it. Because it's a drain on the system, and you know, so it's got to really be a compelling issue where they felt like, yeah, man. I mean, and it's typically if the state fucks up during their case in chief, like that's typically where like a horrible mistake is made, or like something that is like that whole you can't unring a bell process, or that I'm mm-hmm. talking about, where like something is said that's going to impact the jury to the point where they're not going to be able to be unbiased because of what they heard. Because like, you know, a judge will give an instruction. You are not to like everything that guy just said, you can't listen to it. Well, like you were just saying, we're all human beings. It doesn't work like that. Mm-mm. It doesn't work like that. You know, like one of my go-to tricks is, you know, like if I've got something I know that I can't necessarily get in because they're going to object to it, I try to get as much of it out just so the jury can hear it before the objection comes, because you can't unring a bell. Mm-hmm. You just can't. It's like, it's there. The judge will give the instruction. You are not allowed to use that, but subconsciously it's there. The seed
is there. Yeah.
Totally. So, you know, in terms of his appellate process, I don't think that's going to go anywhere. I think he's done. You know, in terms of Mark Redwine, you know, I think that's probably going to be the last we're going to see of him, you know, and I hope that, you know, that family, Elaine and his brothers are, you know, find some kind of solace in that, you know, because it's such a devastating thing to lose somebody like that. And, you hope that, you know, that gives them some kind of relief, and it's probably a little bit of a hollow relief, but it's relief nonetheless. And at least there was some justice, and he didn't, you know, we say that he didn't die in vain, but he really did. You know, it's clearly something that didn't have to happen. You know, and I think it's one of those things where you kind of really have to examine like what you were looking at initially. You know, this case really didn't start on November 12th, man, or 18th, whatever day it was. It started in that divorce court, And that's when this case started. And, you know, maybe when you have cases like this, that's because it took years, man, for them to like start really acknowledging, you know, women just being in these abusive relationships to where they really started drafting statutes to protect them, you know, because in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, when women were essentially powerless and stuck in these abusive
marriages. The 80s.
And, oh my God, the 80s. And, you know, I mean, still now, to be honest with you, I mean, yes, women have come a long way, you know, but they're still not where they need to be, you know, in terms of equality. And, you know, it's one of those things where you, you know, you hope that the law starts to evolve and catch up with where we need to be as a society. So it's like you have these types of cases where, you know, you have a situation like that where they have to start addressing the potential of what can happen. And I realize that we don't have crystal balls, but like with a guy like that, and, you know, and she had done what she could do, you know, she went and got the OP. And, you know, it still didn't help. And it's like, you know, I was sitting there thinking, to be honest with you, and this is going to be my last thought. And I'm like, as soon as they discovered those pictures, like if I were Elaine, I would have been going into my attorney and saying, okay, I want King Dylan added to the order of protection. This guy is what he does in his personal life until it bleeds into what my son knows about him. And he is off. Like there's something off with you. Like, you know what I mean? And like, I think there would have been enough there to where a judge would have probably granted that OP where Dylan was a protected party. Cause that's kind of like where my mind went with it. Because it's like the whole thing where the judge is like, well, he was ordered. Well, yeah. I mean, the parenting agreement is a court order, but like she had an avenue. She were my client. I'm saying, okay, well, I'm filing an order of protection. I'm not sending that fucking kid out there. He's not stable, you know, like he's just not, you know, so, and it probably would have been granted at the very least. I would have gotten a temporary order of protection. And if we had to go to the plenary hearing, you know, seeking a 2-year order, it would have stopped it, you know, cause it's like, so, you know, it's a terrible tragedy. I mean, I'm with you. I'm incredibly relieved that the jury came back the way they did on a tough case for the state because it was all circumstantial. But, you know, I'm with you. I feel like justice was done to the extent that it could be, you know, but notwithstanding that, you know, it was still just a horribly tragic case. And so, and I thank you for letting me weigh in on it, man.
Thank you for joining and for giving such amazing insights. I'm so grateful for this. I've learned so much. I hope my listeners have learned something too. Tell my listeners how to find you.
The pod's called Defense Diaries. The whole first season is basically a serialized, very long, but very interesting. We've tried to do a good job with it, and I think that we've accomplished that. But it's a really deep dive into the John Wayne Gacy case. I know Eric has told you guys about it. You know, my dad was Gacy's lawyer back in 78, gave me those tapes. So we tried to, like I said, early on, we tried to do something a bit different with it. And I think that we came up with an entirely new narrative of that case. So, but it's densely packed. We try to fill it with a lot of information. It's not a casual listen. There's no bantering and laughing and chatting and shit. You know, we're packing it in. So like, if you start drifting off, like I do when I listen to podcasts, just thinking about something, you're going to have to rewind it because you'll miss all.
You're going
to
miss it.
You will, you know, so, but, and yeah, so it's Defense Diaries. We're available on every platform. And if you listen and enjoy it, like Eric said, and for him as well, because it means so much to us in terms of us kind of getting out to the world at large, those ratings and reviews, especially on Apple and now on Spotify, are huge for us, you know? So if you enjoy what we do and appreciate the hard work that we put into these things for you guys, the tiny gift that you can give us to pay back is take a couple minutes of your time and just click that 5 stars. And if you have a couple more minutes to just write something, you know, that lets other people know that are looking for podcasts, because there's so many of them, that, you know, what we bring to the table is something that's worth their time. So, you know, for both Eric and I, that's absolutely huge, and it's massively appreciated by both of us.
Thank you for listening and watching. I'm so grateful for all of you. You make this the best job that I could have ever asked for. So thanks for sticking with me through this story and for staying here and for listening. Thank you, Bob, so much for your participation here. I had a great time talking about this case with you, and I would love to have you back anytime.
I'd love to come back, man. Like, anytime, dude. Like, I mean that sincerely. I'll always love to collab with you, man. And I guarantee you we'll be doing some live shit together out there too. So,
oh, for sure.
I missed the last one, but I'm not missing, like, the next one I'm not missing. So,
it's
the beginning of a beautiful friendship, man. So,
absolutely.
I'm super thankful that you put me on, and I'm grateful. And thanks for giving me the opportunity to weigh in.
Sure. And I just want to tell my listeners and viewers that if you think you know anything about the John Wayne Gacy case, think again. That's all I'm going to say. Listen to Bob's show. Thanks, you might learn something different that you didn't even know happened. So, and with that, thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. Stay safe, New Mexico.